Greetings from the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts, serving the Cape, the Islands, and the South Coast as part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The Ledger delivers information and entertainment to the print-impaired and blind from our Cape-based volunteer readers, as well as from our partner broadcaster, the Talking Information Center in Marshfield. You may sometimes hear their content, but it's the Cape's very own Audible Local Ledger broadcasting it. My name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from today's e-edition of the Fall River Herald News, dated today, Tuesday, February 25th. And we start, as we always do, with the weather. Thick cloud cover today, but as I'm sure you've felt, it is warm, unseasonably warm. 48 to 55 is the high. 35 to 42 will be the low tonight. Tomorrow, Wednesday, rain and drizzle arrive. 45 to 52 high, again, unusually warm. 36 to 43 overnight, and it's going to start to chill down a little bit later in the week. Thursday, partly sunny and windy. Also, 46 to 53, and then 24 to 31 overnight. So now we're getting down into the 20s Thursday evening. And on Friday, partly sunny and cold, relatively, to the rest of the week. 35 degree high, 23 degree low. Saturday, clouds and sunshine with a 34 degree high and a 16 degree low. And moving over to the lottery, our results for Massachusetts, we'll read both Mass and Rhode Island in Sunday's drawing. The Mass midday number was 6073. The Mass evening drawing was 0455. The Rhode Island numbers for the midday was 0661, and in the evening was 5365. For the big ticket items, Mass cash numbers were 3, 17, 20, 22, and 30. Good luck for all of you who play the game. Moving to the cover of today's Fall River Herald News, there's a two-thirds of the front page is the famous picture of Iwo Jima's flag raising. Then in clockwise order, there is a clear veteran, a U.S. Marine veteran, speaking with a microphone. There is a picture of a black and white battle shot of a flamethrower on Iwo Jima. And then there is the ceremony. There are three or four pictures of the ceremony. And doesn't have a lot of text. It's just memorializing the 75th anniversary of the Iwo Jima flag raising. This month marks the 75th anniversary of the Marines' amphibious landing on Iwo Jima. The Marine Corps League observed Iwo Jima Recognition Day at Bicentennial Park February 19th. Based on raising the flag on Iwo Jima, an iconic photograph taken by Joe Rosenthal on February 23, 1945, of five Marines and a Navy corpsman raising a U.S. flag atop Mount Suribachi, Fall River's monument is an exact replica, one-third the size of the Iwo Jima Memorial in Washington, D.C. And the headline again reads, "Never Forget." Above that story, we read everything on the cover. Presidential election underway with early voting. And this is written by Chris Lisinski and Katie Lannon of the Statehouse News Service. In Brookline, completed Massachusetts presidential primary ballots began streaming in Monday morning when the state officially began its first ever period of early voting in a primary contest. Massachusetts offered early voting ahead of the 2016 and 2018 November general elections, but the state is in new territory this week with 5 days designated for ballot casting before the March 3rd presidential primary. Secretary of State William Galvin, who's kicked off the week with a press conference at Brookline Town Hall to outline the options available to voters, said his office's webpage on early voting received 35,000 views over the weekend alone. Quote, "This is the first time we've had early voting in a primary here in Massachusetts, and I'm delighted to say it seems like it's been very well received," Galvin said. The first day of early voting in Fall River was off to a strong start. By 4 p.m., some 123 voters had cast their ballots, making for a good turnout, according to Elections Commissioner Kelly Souza Young. Quote, "It's a good indicator that it will be busy this week," Souza Young said. Susie Young said during the two periods of early voting in 2018, the city counted 1,300 ballots. Voting in Fall River will be offered this week only, Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and Wednesday until 7 p.m. in the atrium at One Government Center. In 2016, the last presidential cycle, about 1 million voters cast ballots during a two-week early voting period before the general election, constituting about 1/3 of all votes cast. Another two-week stretch ahead of the 2018 general midterm election attracted about 600,000 early voters, Galvin said. While Galvin said it is too early to predict turnout in either early voting or the primary race itself, he said precincts across the state, which may operate different early voting hours from one another, reported a generally good reception and good turnout in the first hour they were open Monday. The secretary stressed that early cast ballots are final and that voters will not have a chance to change their minds on election day. Quote, if they have some doubt as to their choice or they want to wait for additional debate or want to see what's happening in other states, they probably shouldn't do early voting, Galvin said. But if you know what you want to do and have decided what you want to do, early voting's an excellent opportunity to get it in. Not to worry about the weather, not to worry about a crowd, not to worry about a schedule. Early voting will end at the close of polls on Friday, allowing Galvin's office to process voter rolls and ensure those who already cast ballots aren't eligible to do so on the Super Tuesday primary date. Applications for absentee ballots will remain available until 12 p.m. Monday and can be submitted either in person at local election offices or by mail. Asked if there was no excuse not to vote with several options now available, Galvin agreed. There's plenty of opportunities to vote, he said. More than 12 voters filtered in and out of Brookline Town Hall during the roughly half hour that Galvin was on site. Tracy McLeod, who cast her vote shortly after 9 a.m. with her family, said she'll be away March 3rd and that the early voting period was more convenient than filing an absentee ballot. Quote, we're about to travel, so it's great, because we want to participate, McLeod, a first-time early voter, said. Another voter, Timothy McDonald, said he preferred early voting to filling an absentee ballot because it retained the excitement of the polling place. It's a bit more convenient for me, McDonald said. It's also just more fun. I get my I voted sticker. You get the whole experience of the environment. It's kind of fun, honestly. The House and Senate approved and funded the newest early voting period in a fiscal year 2019 closeout budget that passed in January. They haven't authorized early voting ahead of the September 1st state primary. As Massachusetts voters began casting their presidential ballots, Auditor Suzanne Bump used her testimony before the Ways and Means Committee Monday to highlight costs associated with early voting. Quote, this is an important step forward in terms of voter access, but contrary to law, municipal funding for the early voting now underway has not been provided to cities and towns, she told the committee. In 2017, Bump's office determined that parts of the early voting law imposed an unfunded mandate on cities and towns, making the state responsible for reimbursing those costs. She asked legislators to write a permanent funding mechanism for early voting, specifically pitching bills filed by Representative Steve Altrino and House Minority Leader Brad Jones. The Jones bill, which is House Number 675, met its likely end when the Election Laws Committee included it in a study ordered earlier this month. The House referred Altrino's bill, which is House 4534, which has nearly identical language, to the Election Laws Committee on February 5th. Galvin, in his own budget testimony earlier this month, said Baker's $44.6 billion spending plan for fiscal 2021 was not adequate to support early voting in our November election come next fall. Bump, on Monday, said she was giving and joining Galvin's call for your recognition that elections cost money and that our reputation for honest and fair elections is compromised when there's insufficient funding to cover their legitimate costs. A Democrat, Bump is supporting U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren for president and joined State Senator Patricia Gelin and Representative Christine Barber to canvass for her this weekend in Somerville. Fellow Democrat Galvin said Monday that he hasn't decided who he'll support in the presidential primary, but he's not planning a public endorsement. He pointed to chaos in the Iowa Democratic caucuses this cycle as a reason for the state's top elections official to keep a distance from the race. Quote, I think voter confidence is the most important thing, Galvin said. I have the right to make a decision, but I chose not to make an endorsement precisely for that reason. And we'll move into the paper. Local news section, attorney in case of nude photo sharing wants the charges dropped, by Laura Damon of the Newport Daily News in Newport. A 37-year-old man connected to an alleged photo-sharing ring of Flint audio video customers' private photos had a felony charge of access to computer for fraudulent purposes dismissed on February 6th. The following day, the attorney for another defendant named in the case filed a reply memorandum in support of the dismissal of his client's remaining charges. Adam M. Gilling, 37 years old, still faces a felony charge of conspiracy. The reason for the recent dismissal of his other charge, provided in court records, mirrors the reason given for the dismissal of the charge from other defendants in the case, Gary W. Gagne, 60, George Quintal, 35, and Daniel A. Anton, 36, in January. The facts giving rise to the charge fall outside the 3-year statute of limitations. Quote, after the 2016 dates were initially charged, a subsequent investigation revealed that the actual act of taking the photos from the computer system predated the statute of limitations. Christy Dorace, public information officer with the Office of Attorney General Peter Noronha, said in a January email when the charge was dismissed for Gagne, Quintal, and Anton. Gilling faced that same charge, count one, but his January court date has been rescheduled to February, according to court records. Two charges are still pending against Gagne, access to computer for fraudulent purposes and conspiracy. Anton still faces two charges, access to computer for fraudulent purposes and conspiracy. Quintal still faces 4 counts of access to computer for fraudulent purposes and 5 counts of conspiracy. Rhode Island State Police launched an investigation in May of 2018 after a non-implicated Flint audio-video employee told the state trooper that Quintal, who was working as the store's sales associate manager at the time, was obtaining nude images of female customers from their electronic devices without their knowledge or consent, according to a state police report included in court documents. The subsequent investigation spurred charges for Quintal, but also the Middleton store's co-owners, Gagne and Anton, as well as 3 former employees. Jeffrey P. Pruitt, 44, is facing 2 charges, access to computer for fraudulent purposes and conspiracy. The charges levied against Terrence M. Roy, 48 years old, were dismissed after his recent death, according to court records. A motion to dismiss count 1, access to computer for fraudulent purposes on the grounds of an expired statute of limitations, was filed on behalf of Gagne by his attorney, Peter A. DiBiase, on August 27th of 2019. Now, in a reply memorandum in support of a motion to dismiss counts 2 and 4, which were filed on February 7th, DiBiase is pushing for the dismissal of his client's remaining 2 charges. The argument for dismissal hinges on one central point. According to the legal filing, the access to computer for fraudulent purposes statute, quote, does not reach the conduct outlined in the information package, which was only later addressed by the General Assembly in Computer Trespass and Unauthorized Dissemination of Indecent Material statutes. Quote, seeking to inflate its case into a felony, the state has seized on the access to computer for fraudulent purposes statute. This provision was enacted in 1979 as part of an early legislative effort to cope with the phenomenon of powerfully wide available computers, which through the internet had almost unlimited reach, DiBiase wrote in the reply memo. By its terms, the Access to Computer for Fraudulent Purposes statute was intended to penalize the use of this new and dangerous instrumentality to perpetrate frauds. A companion section, the intentional access, alteration, damage, or destruction of any computer, computer system, etc. statute, criminalized the separate problem of unauthorized access to another person's computer for a fraudulent purpose. Neither section, however, envisioned the conduct outlined in the information package, the authorized access to a computer, followed by the unauthorized copying of a file, leaving the originals intact, DiBiase argued in the reply memo. So, getting pretty technical in that court case. Sounds like a lot of wordsmithing going on. And moving on into the paper, a little further on in, local. City woman charged with DUI and abusive infant appears in court by Laura Damon of the Newport Daily News. The 40-year-old Fall River woman charged with driving under the influence and child abuse after police say she had her infant child in the car while driving erratically on West Main Road early Saturday did not enter pleas in district court Monday. Bail for Valerie Ogaro was set at $10,000 with surety, which was posted by a bail bondsman, a court clerk said. District Court Judge Colleen Hastings ordered Ogaro not to have contact with the child and follow the mandates outlined by the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Ogaro also was ordered not to drive, not to consume alcohol, and she was referred to pretrial services for alcohol and mental health monitoring. Ogaro has a bail review scheduled for March 3rd, a court clerk said Monday. According to Portsmouth Police, Ogaro drove erratically on West Main Road just after midnight Saturday. Ogaro's vehicle was stopped, and while speaking with her, police noticed an overturned child safety seat in the rear of the vehicle. They discovered a 19-day-old infant secured in that seat, which was overturned and facing the floor of the vehicle. Officers immediately removed the child, who appeared lethargic and was transported to Hasbro Children's Hospital by the Portsmouth Fire Department. The infant was treated at Hasbro and has been released to the custody of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, hopefully never to face the floor in an overturned seat again. And from page one local, DEM seeks comments on 275-unit housing development proposed near Tiverton Wetlands by Marsha Pobzesnik of the Newport Daily News in Tiverton. A 275-unit housing development referred to as Tiverton Heights, proposed for 135 acres on the north side of Sousa Road, is back before the town for comment on a proposal to alter freshwater wetlands. It's the largest development the planning board has ever reviewed. The comment is being sought by the State Department of Environmental Management, or the DEM. The DEM's Office of Water Resources, in a letter to the town, said it will take comment on the proposed alteration of some 13,865 feet of freshwater wetlands until March 26th. Comments must be in writing, legible, and contain a discernible name, address, and signature, according to the DEM. The plan can be reviewed at DEM offices at 235 Promenade Street in Providence. The planning board gave master plan approval to the plan by Portsmouth-based developer Christopher Harkins in late 2016. Harkins' attorney last year asked for a one-year continuance so the master plan could continue to be vested while the project was under review. The property on Sousa Road is 135 acres, but only 77 are in line for development because of the amount of wetlands. DEM said in its letter that the freshwater wetlands affected by the proposed project include swamp, stream, 50-foot perimeter wetland, 100-foot riverbank wetland, and 100-year floodplain. During hearings prior to master plan approval, concerns were voiced about the density of the development. The fire chief was concerned about water pressure and volume. Traffic at the intersection of Sousa and Main Roads was a concern, with the developer being asked to contact the state about putting a traffic light at that intersection, which includes Schooner Drive and the villages at Mount Hope Bay. Initially, Harkins had proposed 305 units, but reduced his plan to 275 condominium-type units that would be a mix of single-family homes, duplexes, and apartment buildings. There would be green spaces and shared amenities in this walkable, quote-unquote, community. One of the conditions of master plan approval was that only 40% of the units could be three-bedroom to help reduce the impact on the schools. The other 60% would be one- and two-bedroom units. The developer said the project would be marketed to empty nesters and young professionals. And also from page one local, which is actually on page five, lobster trap tag from a sunken Rhode Island-based boat discovered during a beach cleanup in England. by Sean Flynn of the Newport Daily News. A lot of Newport Daily News reporting going on in the Fall River Herald today. When the lobster boat Holly and Alexander sunk south of Nantucket in 2003, the crew had been hauling from 1,954 lobster traps located on the bottom of the ocean 100 miles offshore along the continental shelf. Each trap had its own lobster trap tag, according to the boat's owner, William Bill Palumbo. At least one of those lobster tags floated more than 3,000 miles from the Nantucket area to the coast of Cornwall, England, where it was recently recovered by a volunteer from Friends of Porthoras Cove, which conducts regular beach cleanups. Delia Webb, chairperson of the Cornwall Volunteer Group, contacted the editor of the Newport Daily News and asked to be put in contact with W.R. Palumbo, the name on the lobster tag. Her research showed the boat had been operating out of Newport. Quote, "We face the Atlantic, so we get a lot of American and Irish flotsam," Webb said in a telephone interview Wednesday evening from England. "We collect it to show students the flow of the ocean currents and how pollution can last in the ocean for years. Without regular beach cleanups, we wouldn't be able to keep our coasts clean." Establishing the contact was easy, considering Palumbo, owner of Palumbo Fisheries Limited, has his main office on the sixth floor of the Admiral Tower at 221 3rd Street. Palumbo now owns and operates three lobster boats, the 77-foot Endeavour, the 72-foot Freedom, and the 77-foot Timothy Michael, out of the State Pier in Newport. He sells his lobsters to his other company, Boston Wholesale Lobster, based in Lynn. He also provides lobsters along with other boats to the Lobster Shack on the State Pier. Quote, "When the Holly and Alexander sank in 2003, everyone was able to get off the boat and into a life raft. Thankfully, they were all rescued without injury," Palumbo said. There were four lobster fishermen on the boat at the time. Each of Palumbo's boats are licensed to haul from 1,954 traps under the management plan of the offshore lobster fishery. All offshore license holders are allocated a certain number of traps they're allowed to fish, and each lobster trap has a tag that can be identified by National Marine Fisheries, he explained. "You have just so many tags per license," Palumbo said. "You have to replace the tags every year. If we were boarded by an enforcement official, whether at land or offshore on the fishing grounds, every trap has to be tagged in current so enforcement officials know a boat isn't fishing illegally." Palumbo said he doesn't know why the Holly and Alexander sank, except that it took on water for some reason. Quote, "When the boat sank, we tried to recover all the traps in the ocean, because they're very expensive, but we didn't get all of them." Palumbo said he wasn't surprised that one of the tags ended up in Cornwall, because the ocean currents travel that direction. The Holly and Alexander was a 65-foot steel boat built in 1975 at the Rhode Island Marine Shipyard in Narragansett, Rhode Island. Quote, "At the time, it was a state-of-the-art boat," Palumbo said. The boat was the sister ship of the Palumbo-owned Kristen and Michael, built by Gladding Hearn Shipyard in Somerset in 1973 and also fished out of Newport. Palumbo was in partnership with his cousin, Raymond Palumbo, when they got into the lobstering business in 1971. At the beginning, they were fishing with a 50-foot wooden boat called the Palumbo One that was hand-built by Bill's uncle, also named Raymond Palumbo. When the Palumbos had the new fishing vessels built, the two of them, they named them for their children. Kristen was Bill's daughter and Michael was Raymond's son. Holly was Raymond's daughter and Alexander was Bill's son. When the cousins split the business several years later, Bill took the Holly and Alexander and Raymond Palumbo took the Kristen and Michael. The Friends of Porthoras Cove is a group of about 25 volunteers who regularly clean the cove and the beaches, Webb said. "Because lobster tags are so available, we try to trace them through social media," she said. "We have a collection of lobster tags." Quote, "Items such as these lobster tags are very useful to us as we deliver free marine conservation educational workshops to schools across the county. And cross-Atlantic flotsam like this shows how the oceanic currents and their timescales work," Webb wrote in her initial email to the Daily News. Porthoras Cove is about 6 miles from Land's End, the most westerly point of mainland Cornwall and England, Webb said. State Guidance Highlights School Improvement Plan Priorities by Katie Lannon of the State House News Service in Boston. State education officials are especially interested in pre-kindergarten expansion, early college, and workforce diversity initiatives as they gear up to review the first set of local achievement gap-closing plans required under a new law. The $1.5 billion 7-year school funding overhaul requires school districts to prepare 3-year plans detailing steps they'll take to reduce persistent disparities among different student groups. Guidance from the State Department of Elementary and Education indicates what officials might be looking for in the plans. School districts will receive the first round of new dollars associated with the law after Governor Charlie Baker signs the fiscal 2021 budget into law this summer. Baker's budget plan recommended a $304 million increase in Chapter 70 school aid. And we will have an abbreviated version. We are out of basically local news right now. And we will move over to get the obituaries in this half-hour reading of Fall River's Herald News. Bertha Fournier is our first obituary of Fall River, who at the age of 87 passed away February 21st. Funeral will be held February 27th at 9 a.m. from the Boyko Memorial Funeral Home in Fall River, followed by a massive Christian burial at 10 a.m. at St. Stanislaus Church in Rockland Street, Fall River, and interment will be in Notre Dame Cemetery in Fall River. Calling hours held Wednesday, tomorrow, from 4 to 7 p.m. Our next obituary is of Dr. David B. Pomfret of Jamestown, Rhode Island, who passed away at the age of 82 on Saturday, February 22nd. He was beloved husband of Anna Pomfret for 56 years. Visiting hours will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, February 28th, in the Fagan Quinn Funeral Home, located at 825 Boston Neck Road in North Kingston. His funeral mass will be held Saturday, February 29th, at 11 a.m. in St. Mark Church, 16 Narragansett Avenue in Jamestown, Rhode Island, followed by interment in St. Mark Cemetery, Jamestown, and a reception at Bay Voyage. There will be a celebration of life at Stonehill College in late spring. Eugenia Gormley is our next obituary of Portsmouth, Rhode Island, who passed away at the age of 99 Thursday, February 20th. Calling hours will be held Thursday, February 27th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. in Connor's Funeral Home in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Services for Eugenia will also be held at Connor's Funeral Home immediately following calling hours at 11 a.m. with burial to follow at St. Columba Cemetery's Chapel, 465 Browns Lane, Middleton, Rhode Island. Our next obituary is of Marianne Palestine of Fall River, who at the age of 70 passed away February 20th. A celebration of her life will be held March 15th at 1 p.m. at the Country Club of New Bedford in North Dartmouth. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that donations be made to her daughter's, Sarah's, Pan Mass Challenge ride to benefit Dana-Farber. Arrangements are in the care of Waring Sullivan Home if you need more information. Sarah Baldaya is our next obituary of Fall River, who at the age of 100 passed away February 22nd, former wife of the late Joseph Baldaya. Funeral to which relatives and friends are invited will be held Thursday, February 27th at 10:30 a.m. from the Oliveira Funeral Home in Fall River, followed by a massive Christian burial at 11 a.m. at Santo Cristo Church, Columbia Street in Fall River. Calling hours will be held Thursday from 9 to 10:30 a.m. prior to the funeral. And our last obituary for today is of Gladys T. Walsh of Fall River, who at the age of 93 passed away on February 23rd. She was wife of the late Edward F. Walsh. She was a graduate of BMC Durfee High School. A wake and her funeral mass will be held Thursday at 11 a.m. at St. Thomas More Church in Somerset. Family will be greeting visitors starting at 10:30 a.m. at the church. Burial will be at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Fall River. The wake will be omitted. I've just read that as an addition. You do not need to send flowers, but you can make a donation in her name to the Alzheimer's Association. That concludes our reading for today. If you know someone who could use our service or you're interested in volunteering or donating to our nonprofit to keep us on the air, please call 508-539-2030 or visit our website, audibleloculledger.org. As always, thank you for tuning in and all your continued support. This is your reader, Eric, saying bye for now.